Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The shadow of ECOT grows longer and darker for politicians who once praised the online schools and its founder, Bill Lager. Candidates for governor, U.S. Senate, and other races have scrutinized the primary results. Now they begin the push toward November's crucial midterm general election. And Democrats still hope for a blue wave, even after what many saw as a low tide for voter turnout among Democrats last week. Joining us for this week's Weekly Reporters Roundtable, Jesse Balmert from the Cincinnati Enquirer. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch. Thank
you. Good morning.
And Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thank you.
Great to be here.
First to ECOT. Last week, State Auditor Dave Yost released an audit that claimed officials with the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow deliberately inflated attendance figures, and he referred the case to federal and county prosecutors for possible prosecution of fraud. This follows a claim last month that the auditor's office and state education officials ignored a whistleblower who said ECOT was gaming its attendance software to get more money from the state. Where are we at right now? Who wants to bat this baby back at me?
Well, we're at a couple places. We're having prosecutors review for possible charges. I think the most likely charge would be fraud or theft. That's going on. We're waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on ECOT's challenge to the Ohio Department of Education's ruling that they were overpaid in the first place. Most people expect that to go the state's way. We shall see. And the school itself is under liquidation. So they're hoping that if they got a favorable ruling from the Supreme Court, they might reopen in the fall. But Friday, they had the start of an auction to sell off all their possessions and I think the building itself as well. So it seems like the school, which is technically suspended operations, is probably closed for good.
Was there an issue over something being sold that law enforcement, maybe it was the city?
The computers.
There's
an issue,
right,
about. They used a system called ActiveTrack to track student participation online, and the auditor's office asked for those computer records to be preserved for his investigation. And I believe they did that, or they downloaded it for him. I don't know that they preserved the computers themselves, but they got the information he wanted off of them.
Dave Yost, a state auditor, has given a couple awards to ECOT over time, and I've still been trying to figure out, were they mistaken that ECOT wasn't doing as good of a job as they to warrant those awards, or was the state auditor's office just not paying very close attention? Do we know?
If you look at ECOT and a lot of these charters, the playing field has not been the same for them since their inception. I mean, a public school is treated much differently than ECOT and some of these other schools. And I think the oversight in general wasn't there. I mean, that's what we're obviously seeing. There was an oversight at points that there probably would have been had that been a public school.
And I think Dave Yost essentially at that press conference said that they were perfunctory, which I'm sure everyone who's
these
ever
awards?
Gotten the
not
award.
Not important.
Not important. And I'm sure every township and county that got an award for excellence is now a little bummed out by that. But
okay.
It's another trophy, right? It's another trophy on yourself. He basically said that if entities that he audits meet certain criteria,
they automatically
get the award. And he tried to downplay at his press conferences, as Jesse said, he tried to downplay the significance of those awards. But to which I would ask, then why give them?
Right.
Right. I mean, it probably takes time and energy, mm-hmm, which equals money.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a problem for him politically after the fact, since obviously this isn't just, oh, we woke up in 2018 and this is a problem. And so reporters and obviously the Democrats are looking back and saying, oh, look at all these awards of excellence. Look at all these things that, like attending their graduation ceremonies,
right,
that you did. And why would you do that if this school was in so much trouble and such a waste of taxpayer dollars?
Because either it wasn't at the time or you didn't care. I mean, that's the answer. But back to his audit, he did find, Yost did find that the school had misspent money on advertising last year when the ODE, the Department of Education, was kind of going after on the attendance. They were running ads with state dollars slamming the Department of Education, which I thought was kind of weird at the time. It seemed like, why are they taking tax dollars to slam a government entity? But that's what they're doing. Yost found that was an improper use of tax dollars and has issued a finding for recovery, which means the Attorney General's office will now try and recover those funds. And then he also found that they were overpaid in 16-17 school year, much like the Department of Education found. But he didn't put an amount on that overpayment because I guess they didn't have enough information from ECOT to say what it was, but he seemed certain that it was a significant overpayment.
And that'll become known?
Well, it wasn't really stated clearly, but presumably the records from the computer that they sought will allow them to better calculate what their ECOT's attendance was during that school year. So I presume we'll be getting another report, but that's not for certain.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. We're talking about ECOT right now, the now shuttered Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow. There is an audit, a new audit that claims that officials with ECOT deliberately inflated attendance figures. Follows a claim last month that the auditor's office and state education officials ignored a whistleblower who said ECOT was gaming its attendance software. What about that whistleblower and the fact that the claims that the state auditor's office and state education officials ignored that whistleblower? Is that a story that has legs, or does it not really matter at this point?
It depends who you listen to. I mean, Auditor Yost made it sound like he said specifically that they had spoken to the whistleblower before and that they already knew everything the whistleblower knew. So he kind of downplayed that. But, you know, you might expect him to downplay that because if they did ignore the whistleblower, that would look kind of bad. So I'm not sure we're real clear on what people did with the whistleblower's information and what they didn't do. It's just not clear to me yet.
Now, the returning of the campaign donations, this is happening all over the place right now. But one person that hasn't returned donations from Bill Lager or his associates is John Husted, Secretary of State John Husted, who is Mike DeWine's running mate for governor, Lieutenant
And one of
governor.
The early supporters, you know, very big supporter of charter schools.
Yeah. So what's his explanation for not returning the money? Anyone? Anything?
He says, do you know?
Yeah, I think the explanation was that his campaign fund no longer exists because it was folded into the DeWine campaign as he is running as lieutenant governor with Mike DeWine. But all of that money from Husted's campaign was transferred over to the DeWine campaign. So you would think as a show of good faith, DeWine campaign could give it back or give it to a charity, as many other politicians have done.
And DeWine did donate some money to charities that he got from. A couple numbers that might be important to your listeners. ECOT, which opened in the year of 2000, has gotten about $1 billion in tax funding over the years. And I think the campaign contributions we've been able to calculate during that time amounted to about $2.5 million, almost all that money going to Republican office holders, who, of course, were in control of the legislature at the time. So, you know, it makes sense.
And
that
have been ever since.
Would be going to. But yeah. Right. And have been the biggest supporters of charter schools.
I wanted to turn to the post-primary discussion. There's a lot to talk about, but I wanted to get at the issue of party unity. It seems like that's a big catchphrase these days. Both sides want to show unity. Used to be assumed after a primary that you moved into a unified state. Everyone says they have it. But Ohio Governor Kasich is withholding his support for fellow Republican Mike DeWine until the gubernatorial primary winner vows support for two things, Medicaid expansion and Jobs Ohio. Medicaid expansion being the expansion by way of the Affordable Care Act to funding from that. The state, the Governor Kasich managed through
It insures about 700,000.
Right, 700 Ohioans are covered. And then the Jobs Ohio is he privatized the liquor revenue in Ohio and funded Jobs Ohio, which is largely opaque still at this point. We really don't know how they're spending the money.
Right.
Is the governor seeking total support or some support or what? Because DeWine already is on the record on some of this stuff. And is he going to change his tune or what's going to happen?
You know, it's interesting because Rich Cordray, the Democratic nominee, kind of sounds at times like he's kind of courting. I don't think he is, but he sounds like he's courting Kasich's support because he and Kasich agree on some big issues, Medicaid, Jobs Ohio being two of them. And during the primary, you know, when all the Republicans were moving far to the right, no one really wanted Kasich's support at that point. So the question is, you know, is his support a big deal? Because you wouldn't expect a Democrat to get it. And that, you know, and then.
Well, the thing is, Kasich endorsed Mary Taylor, who trashed.
She ran away from
expansion.
It. Yeah, yeah.
Now he's withholding it.
Yeah, John Kasich on Friday was in Michigan talking to press people there and said he would definitely vote for Mike DeWine. When I spoke with his spokesman, it was like, well, he's not going to vote for Elizabeth Warren-backed Rich Cordray, of course. And so I don't think there is a chance that John Kasich is so no longer a Republican that he's going to vote for a Democrat
right.
in the governor's race. But whether he will, you know, stick his stamp of approval on Mike DeWine, I think he wants to sit down with him and talk about Medicaid expansion. But like you said, Mike DeWine has already made it pretty clear that he thinks Medicaid expansion would have to change. He wasn't quite as like, I'm just going to slash it completely as Mary Taylor was, because he said there have been some benefits.
He's
from
more supportive of it.
Yeah, there have been some benefits for those getting addiction treatment and so forth. But I think he'd be supportive of like a block grant or something from the federal government. And so, you know, how much buy-in will Kasich need to say, I endorse Mike DeWine? And honestly, how much does John Kasich's endorsement help Mike
right.
DeWine?
Right.
Don't you think the governor's trying in some ways to protect his legacy? I mean, Jobs Ohio and Medicaid expansion would be one of his two major accomplishments, I think.
I think so. And I also think John Kasich has been flirting with another run in 2020. And I think it looks good for him to stay a little bit in the middle, either as an alternative to Trump or as an independent candidate. And so I think this is a little bit about his legacy, a little bit about his future, and a little bit about Mike DeWine.
Right.
And for Cordray, I mean, I don't think Cordray cares about Kasich's endorsement. I think Cordray would like Kasich's supporters. This race is going to be decided by independents. And a lot of independents, Kasich appeals to a lot of independent voters. And I think that's Cordray's real target. He's trying to get those voters.
And Cordray was interesting because he said, you know, I would protect Medicaid expansion, which he has said all along, all of the Democrats did. But the thing that was interesting was when he said, oh, and I'm going to keep Jobs Ohio, too, which, like you said, is a very not transparent organization. And Democrats have railed about it. There were lawsuits over it. So I thought that was the interesting bit of that. He said that he would add more transparency to Jobs Ohio. Now, what that looks like hasn't been fleshed out. I know Mike DeWine has also said he would like to do something with Jobs Ohio and perhaps have public audits of it. So I think neither of them are very far apart on Jobs Ohio, but it was interesting that a Democrat came out and said this Republican-backed idea, which Democrats railed against, is suddenly A-OK by me.
But I think transparency or lack thereof was the big issue for the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was.
And for Mike DeWine as well. Yeah, I mean, Jobs Ohio, it might be a Kasich accomplishment, but I guess I'll just have to take his word for it.
We don't know what they do.
Don't know what they bring in. We don't know what they shell out. We don't know.
And so part of the challenge, for example, was when Amazon was looking for a new second headquarters, all of these states were like, look at all the fun toys we're going to give you to bring them to our area. And we would ask questions of Jobs Ohio, like, what incentives are you offering to Amazon? Like, how are you helping these cities get this big deal to come to Ohio? And it's just silence because they're not going to tell you.
Right.
We will continue our conversation. It is our weekly reporters roundtable. Still with us, Joe Ingles for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, and Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher, and our weekly reporter roundtable, where we look ahead to what will make news this week. Still with us, Jesse Balburn of the Cincinnati Inquirer, Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, and Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Ohio's primary is behind us. So our attention turns to the general election matchup in races all around the country. Turnout among Democrats has been higher than Republicans, which is typical after the losing party in a presidential election is energized for the next go at the ballot box. The blue wave did not materialize, however, in Ohio, and more Republicans than Democrats, a lot more, turned out to vote. There could be a lot of reasons for this. Let's talk about some of them. Jesse Balmer, Republicans had more competitive races than Democrats had?
Yeah, so the numbers actually ended up being Republicans were about 55% of those who cast their ballots last Tuesday. Democrats were more like 45%. Basically, Republicans are saying this is the death of the blue wave, like it's definitely not going to happen in 2018. And that might be a little early to say, but it certainly wasn't an encouraging sign for Democrats who are looking to turn all of these rallies and you know, anti-Trump sentiments into votes for them. I think some of the reasons David Pepper thinks that maybe you didn't see that massive blue wave was that the Republican primary was very nasty and divisive and all over your airwaves for the
primary.
Governor race between Mary Taylor and Mike DeWine. And so that might have driven people to the polls. And, you know, just there were more state house primaries, I think, more on the Republican side as well. There was one down ticket GOP primary, whereas all of the other statewide office holders for Democrats were basically just incumbents. Mm-hmm. They also said that, you know, the numbers were better than in 2016 primary for president. But I think one big caveat on that was John Kasich was on the ticket on the Republican side. And, you know, anecdotally know of a few people who just wanted to vote for John Kasich, even if they were typically Democrats. So I'm not sure how substantive that swing back has been. But it is interesting because nationally you have seen this enthusiasm on the Democratic side, and it just wasn't there last Tuesday in Ohio.
And one of the things that David Pepper also says is that the Ohio Democratic Party, unlike the Ohio Republican Party, which endorsed candidates, the Ohio Democratic Party did not endorse its gubernatorial candidates.
Right.
So it was basically on all of the candidates to get their followers out versus the party putting out a slate card and saying, go vote for our people. The party did take an active stance in issue one. But he said, you know, they weren't using a lot of the party's resources to get the primary vote out because they didn't want to take sides. And if you remember, that was something that caused a lot of contention in the Democratic Party 4 years ago when they did take sides. So, you know, by not taking sides, they avoided that bad feeling, if you will, among the candidates, you know, because they weren't taking sides. But that also, he says, you know, kind of kept the vote down. So
did they succeed in avoiding that bad feeling? I mean, we know that Joe Schiavone has
endorsed
Rich Cordray. Yeah. What about
Dennis Kucinich has been a little silent on this.
Yeah.
So I do think compared to past situations with the Democrats, Ed Fitzgerald in the last gubernatorial election, Bernie Sanders versus Hillary Clinton, where the party got very involved and Sanders supporters felt very kind of ostracized and on the outs. And even as recently as the U.S. Senate race between Cincinnati Councilman P.G. Sittenfeld and former Governor Ted Strickland, the party really went with Ted Strickland. And I think that just creates divides. It creates people who are upset, people who feel like the younger candidate doesn't have a fair shake at getting some statewide name recognition. And so I do think Democrats avoided that this time around by not endorsing this race. And I think ultimately they probably got the person that they wanted all along.
Anyway.
Right.
But that divides. I mean, you're talking about all the examples of how endorsing in a primary has divided Democrats in the past. There's a lot. But did it do any damage to the Republicans? by endorsing this time?
You know, that was one of the things that the Mary Taylor campaign continued to bring up, was how they felt like the Republican Party had stacked the cards against their campaign.
But she's endorsed Mike DeWine.
Well, during the primary, she continued to bring that up over and over and over. And yes, she has endorsed DeWine now. But, you know, there was a lot of bad feeling, obviously, between DeWine and Taylor during the primary. So I think, you know, even though she's endorsing Taylor or endorsing DeWine, is she doing it, you know, out of the obligation to do so, or is she wholeheartedly, you know, how deep is that? We don't really know that, and we won't until we see, you know, how her followers go and what she does to actually campaign and help Mike DeWine in this effort.
You know, speaking of candidates turning out voters, what about Rich Cordray and his ability to do that? He hasn't been around Ohio that much. He's been running the Consumer Safety Protection Bureau in Washington. Where does he stand? I mean, what are his skills? He did sound strong on election night.
Mm-hmm, he did. And he can bring these other candidates, we were talking about Kucinich a minute ago, and Kucinich was basically saying on election night, we have these big ticket issues and we are going to work to continue to make sure that these things get accomplished. Rich Cordray could go after all of those people who are backing Kucinich or backing, you know, Schiavone or backing Bill O'Neill. He could go after those by, you know, bringing some of their issues to his platform if he wanted, or by, you know, getting some of those people involved with, you know, what he wants to do with some of his plans. So we, you know, it's really too early to say how that's going to actually shake out.
Yeah. What about Bill O'Neill? Gave up a seat on the Ohio Supreme Court.
Well, I think he was
3% of the vote.
I think he was term limited.
Yeah. Oh, he was going to.
It was the age thing.
Or it was the age thing.
It was the age thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think he was going to be going away. I think Joe Schiavone was term limited in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Dennis Kucinich will go back to doing whatever Dennis Kucinich was doing before this. But I do think Cordray, by getting that double-digit victory, showed that he was kind of head and shoulders above the rest of the candidates in this, where I thought maybe Kucinich would be a little closer than he was. And I think he'll also be able to bring in people like Elizabeth Warren, who has a lot of cred in the progressive movement. I think Sherrod Brown being at the top of the ticket will help with those voters too. And if he can kind of get President Barack Obama to come into Ohio, I think that would help with his popularity as well. So I don't know if Rich Cordray himself drives this enthusiasm, but I think he has a few friends.
The 6 degrees of separation he has with some people.
I think he has a few friends who could help.
That helps.
Yeah. The Dispatch published a front page story today saying that Sherrod Brown is all it. You know, that it'd be very highly unlikely that Jim Renacci could
Well, the polling is showing, of course, that Sherrod Brown's ahead, as you would expect.
No surprise, yeah.
No surprise. He's the two-term incumbent. But, you know, it's kind of early. I mean, a poll this early is just that, a poll this early.
Right.
I mean, the race is certain to tighten up, and we'll see how close it gets. But I would have to say, you know, to handicap it at this point, that it's Sherrod Brown's to lose.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard from Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Jesse Balmert with the Cincinnati Inquirer. Sherrod Brown in the last go-around was in a pitched battle against
Josh Mandel.
He's not, it's seen as not being as competitive as a race this time. And I'm wondering if Sherrod Brown can be out there campaigning for other people, since he is, you know, the number one Democrat in the state right now.
Oh, I think they'll all campaign together. I mean, I expect that. Yeah.
And you would expect him to take the leadership role in that.
Yeah.
Because he's, you know, he's the veteran Democrat in the state.
Absolutely. Do you think we're going to have a statewide office holder besides Sherrod Brown? Is it possible?
I think in the Secretary of State's race, perhaps, is it Kathleen Clyde?
Kathleen Clyde, yeah.
She seemed to do pretty well. She seems to be doing pretty well with money. I think that that one might be more competitive. And I also think the attorney general's race is going to be pretty competitive. Dave Yost and Steve Dettelbach. Is it Dettelbach?
Yes. Okay.
You know, all these executive office seats are open races. They're all being vacated by two-term Republicans who can't run again. So by virtue of the fact that they're open seats, they're going to be competitive. But, you know, we've talked about the ECOT thing. That's going to, you know, be something on Yost's shoulder he's going to have to keep batting off. And
on Columbus on the Record, Marianne Sharkey compared it to CoinGate from, you know, the 90s and what kind of brought down the Taft administration. Do you think it's up there with that?
It could be. I, you know, when you look at CoinGate, the ECOT thing is kind of out there still. People, ordinary people, do not understand the CoinGate thing to the extent that, you know, maybe reporters who are reporting on it.
CoinGate was such a...
And, you know, like the ECOT thing is kind of like, okay, well, I know there was something there, but I'm not quite sure. If you think of CoinGate, the thing that really connected with the voters was when you said the state was investing in Beanie Babies. All of a sudden, people know what Beanie Babies are. They know it's a bad investment. And they're like, what?
We have Beanie not Babies.
Seen, yeah, we have not seen the Beanie Babies of the CoinGate scandal yet. Okay. And if there's something out there, you know,
you mean
that
the Beanie Babies of the ECOT.
The ECOT scandal. We have a Republican guy, Bill Lager, who, you know, gave Republicans all this money. And Bill Lager, when he started ECOT, which, by the way, stands for the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow, just in case anyone doesn't know. When he started ECOT, he was coming out of bankruptcy. He was broke. And now he owns millions of dollars of real estate, including a $4 million house in Key West, Florida. Those are visuals that I expect that the Democrats will try and use to make this hit home a little bit, to try and show voters why they care. Voters finance these things. Yeah. This is all tax money.
And that's what they're going to have to do. The Democrats are going to have to use something really visual, something in your face that you can understand and that makes, you know, perfect sense to you to illustrate this ECOT scandal. And I think they will, because we already hear the familiar pay to play, culture, corruption. The Democrats are all talking about.
They're all in on ECOT.
Yeah,
they got their talking points. All in. This is going to be a big issue for them in every race, every state race.
Women have made historic advances in terms of numbers across the country. We're going to talk about that more in depth tomorrow, by the way, at 10 o'clock. We're going to have a special show dedicated to that. But this did not play out for women who support Donald Trump, for one thing, Republicans. In Central Ohio, Liberty Township trustee Melanie Lenihan fell short, where State Senator Troy Balderson succeeded in the tight GOP race to replace Pat Tiberi in Congress, or not replace him, but succeed him. He's already out. In Ohio, Democrats nominated women for 10 of 16 congressional seats. Is this a quirk? Do you think this is actually, you know, we've been talking about the Year of the Women for about 10 years now.
So I think it does show some enthusiasm on the Democratic side, especially for female candidates. Maybe there's a lot of personal stories about the congressional candidates, people who went to a rally and then decided they wanted to run for Congress. I'm not sure if that translates into more female congresswomen from Ohio, because a lot of those 10 of 16 seats are running against incumbent Republicans in areas.
In very safe Republican districts.
And, for example, like the first district down in Cincinnati area, which I think will be a competitive one, is going to be, you know, two male candidates as well. Avtav Perval, the Hamilton County Clerk of Courts, is the Democrat, versus Steve Chabot, the incumbent Republican. And so I think there is that enthusiasm for women on the Democratic side. They did have 10 of 16 congressional candidates. They have Kathleen Clyde, as we already mentioned, is running for Secretary of State. Betty Sutton is the Lieutenant Governor candidate on the Democratic side, whereas on the Republican side, I think there was only one out of the 16 congressional seats were won by a woman. None of their statewide candidates, except for the judges, there are a number of female Republican Supreme Court judge candidates. And so it just kind of draws that contrast. But whether that results in wins, more wins for women in November kind of remains to be seen.
But yeah. Whatever wins there are going to be more women winning on the Democratic side than the Republican side, mm-hmm. just by number.
And when you look at, you know, you were referring to women being engaged in the rallies and that sort of thing. When you look at those rallies, it's mostly women who are engaged on Democratic issues. So you don't see a lot of talk about Republican issues at any of those rallies. So I think, you know, by looking at that, we may kind of get a jaded idea of, you know, how things go and that all women stand on the same platform. And I don't think all women think the same.
Right. Right.
Certainly. The other thing that's worth noting, though, is there are no female governor candidates. Democrats had three in the race at one point, mm-hmm. and all of them dropped out and either joined Cordray's ticket or endorsed Rich Cordray. And obviously, Mary Taylor lost to Mike DeWine on Tuesday. So it's still going to be Nancy Hollister and her, you know, slightly over a week gubernatorial bid as the sole female governor of Ohio so far.
And Nancy Hollister, by the way, who sits on the Ohio Board of Education mm-hmm. nowadays, and they still refer to her as governor.
Yeah, she was lieutenant governor and then was governor when
for about a week when Voinovich went to the Senate.
Went to the U.S. Senate, right?
Right. We're old, Ann. We're old.
Yeah. I can remember that. The House picks a new speaker this week. Tomorrow, as a matter of fact, Larry Householder has had a lot of success on primary day. He wants to be speaker again, and the Perry County lawmaker, who under a shadow of an FBI investigation a decade ago, might just succeed. How did he do it?
So I think there was a lot of organization on Larry Householder's behalf on Tuesday, and he really showed his political acumen with this race. There were a number of open seats for Republicans, and in those cases, it was Larry Householder's pick versus Ryan Smith, who's from Gallia County, and he is the finance chairman and kind of the heir apparent, for lack of a better term, to the Speaker Cliff Rosenberger, who just resigned amid another FBI probe. Mm-hmm. And so I think he just picked the candidates and ran the races. A lot of these were very expensive. There was money from dark groups and from investors. And so, but in most of the cases, Householder's picks won out over Smith's picks. And the result of that is it seems likely that he has the votes to become speaker in 2019, next year. Mm-hmm. But we will be picking somebody to fill out the remainder of Speaker Rosenberger's term tomorrow. And I'm not quite sure if he has the votes among the current members to make that happen.
Yeah, you know, Matt Borges, who worked with Larry Householder when he was in the House before, and who has been very involved, former chair of the Ohio Republican Party, he was talking after this whole thing, and he said, you know, the thing that Larry Householder did is he got out there early with the organization to help these candidates, and that was a key, you know, getting those county endorsements for candidates and getting their name out there and getting them in front of people and talking, that was a real help to those candidates to begin with. And then, of course, when all that money starts coming in, well, that helps too. And, you know, people can look at Larry Householder. I mean, when he runs a campaign, he's a hard campaigner. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's more than shooting up TVs and campaign ads. I mean, he gets out there and he campaigns.
We're talking about 20 races, right?
Yeah, I think it was about 20. Yeah.
Around a dozen, more than a dozen. It depends. Sometimes it's hard to tell which one of these are proxy fights. Yeah. But you can kind of look at the telltale cells of signs of who was spending money in those races.
Is there going to be pressure on people in the vote tomorrow to vote for what might or probably might be in after the general election?
Sure there will. I mean, that's a tremendous amount of pressure, because if these people who are sitting there and they have another term ahead of them are thinking, oh, Larry Householder's going to be in charge, there's like a subtle pressure that, you know, I better support Larry Householder now, put my card on that horse versus, mm-hmm. you know, something that may not exist. You know, that's underlying there.
It's going to be very interesting to watch that.
I think there are about three scenarios. One is Householder, one is Smith, and the other one is they could pick some sort of interim speaker, somebody who's maybe term limited.
A placeholder.
Who hasn't been engaging in this giant speaker's battle and could just keep the ships running on time. But we'll see if that actually happens. I think Householder has a compelling argument.
I think Householder is going to go all in for it. I don't think he's going to let placeholder.
Mm-hmm. One more thing about these Householder candidates. They tend to be the more conservative. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're going into a general election. So are all these Householder candidates actually going to be able to win in November?
Do they all have opponents?
The Democratic Party, they'll have opponents.
So they have opponents. Real but in some opponents? Case, so that's the
okay,
real
well, okay,
question. Yeah. I mean, some of these areas are just going to go for one party over the other, no matter what.
Because of gerrymander. Right. Well, and just because they're in conservative areas. And
mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, there's a seat in Cincinnati that the Democrat won, and he is going to be the nominee almost assuredly. Mm-hmm. So the same happens on the Republican side. But some of them could lose to Democrats. Same with Ryan Smith's supporters as well.
You know, speaking of the House, Democrats are behind 17 seats there. What are some of the expectations that they could make some headway in November?
I think they almost have to pick up seats because they are so far behind.
Right.
They have 33 in the House and 9 in the Senate out of 99 and 33, respectively. And so I think they'll pick up something because they almost have to. But I think if you're looking for like a massive blue wave that's going to take over the Republicans in the Ohio General Assembly, that is not going to happen in 2018.
But if you think of the last time that we had this political climate, that was back in 2006, there was some movement in the House as well. I mean, you saw the House, they did pick up the numbers there. So, it's possible. I don't think we write anything off.
Nothing's impossible. It's possible.
It's possible.
We are going to continue our conversation. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly Reporters Roundtable. How we purchase prescription drugs could be costing the state and you a lot of money. On the surface, drug manufacturers make the product. That's why they're called manufacturers. Then they sell it to pharmacies, which then charge insurance companies and us for the cost of those drugs. But there are also middlemen. They're called pharmacy benefit managers. They negotiate drug prices with manufacturers and reimbursements to pharmacies. Critics say these middlemen are shortchanging pharmacies and pocketing the extra money. Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch. The Dispatch has been working this story for a while, a drug company making big profits. Why is this a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal because it's tax dollars, at least with some of these programs like Medicaid, Medicare, where, you know, those are tax-funded programs that spend a lot of money on pharmaceutical drugs. So you should care about it from that perspective. If you have private insurance, you should also care about it because it could be driving up your private insurance costs. So just about anybody who uses the healthcare system should really care about this issue. Pharmacy benefit managers are, as you said in your intro, middlemen. They negotiate prices with drug manufacturers, and then they reimburse pharmacies to fill prescriptions. So the problem is, as we've written about, is that the amount that they're paying for the drugs is often a lot more than what they're reimbursing the pharmacists. That's called the spread. And that's millions of dollars in Ohio's Medicaid program anyway that they're pocketing. Pharmacy benefit managers, you might know them by names like Express Scripts, CVS Caremark, Optumar X. They're the three big ones. They control about 85% of the market.
Why do they exist? Why are they necessary?
Well, that's a great question. They originally, I think, they came into play to be kind of the middlemen. They processed claims. And it was as simple as that.
That's what I always thought of as Express Scripts.
Right. They process claims and they help people get their prescriptions. They might steer customers towards mail order if you're on certain medications for a long time. But they've kind of gone into this unregulated, very opaque system where they negotiate these prices, negotiate rebates and discounts with manufacturers, and then set the rates that are paid to pharmacists. And this kind of came to light in Ohio's Medicaid program when the pharmacists back in the fall started complaining that their reimbursement rates were in many cases below their cost of acquiring the drug. And that kind of got lawmakers' attention, and that kind of shed light on this, and that's where people started reporting about it. Now you've got President Trump announced his health care plan for prescription drugs on Friday, just really putting a big target on the back of PBMs.
Right.
So we'll see what happens.
What is the likelihood that anything is going to happen?
Well, you know,
it's a free country, right?
Yeah, it's hard to say because, you know, PBMs, pharmaceutical companies, these are huge lobby groups. These are groups that pour millions and millions of dollars into campaign, you know, finance backing and stuff like that. So they don't, I mean, how much they're able to actually get done is saying it is one thing. Let me just say this. Saying it is one thing. Implementing it is quite another thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm dubious. Obviously, the problem's being recognized, which is a step in the right direction. But whether that translates to real action, we'll have to see.
Does it only have to happen at the federal level, or are there actions that they could be taking at the state level?
No, there's actions that they're taking at the state level. And what you hear most about is transparency, almost like the Jobs Ohio, like we were talking about. Nobody knows what the prices are, so nobody can really evaluate. Ohio Medicaid just took a step where they asked for all the information from the pharmacy benefit managers going back a year, and they're going to analyze. And they say the pharmacy benefit managers have turned over this data. They're going to analyze it, and they expect to have a report out in June that'll show spread pricing to what extent it is. So we'll have a better look then. They're also rewriting their contracts with their managed care companies so that going forward this information is going to be available. So if they're paying $100 for a drug and they're reimbursing the pharmacy, or if they're acquiring a drug for $100 and they're paying far less from that and the pharmacies are getting, you know, jerked out of the money, we're going to know that going forward. So that should help the problem. Now, what they're going to do on the federal level, I don't know. We'll have to see what the president says. But he talked a lot about transparency as well.
Mm-hmm. His was a pretty detailed plan as well.
Well, there was a lot in his plan, but a lot of it was ideas. There wasn't a lot of specifics, I thought. That was my, you know. Mm-hmm. But we'll see.
Speaking of drugs, medical marijuana is supposed to hit the scene in September, but Jesse Balmer, there's problems. We've talked about them before. What's the latest?
So the latest is actually happening today. There's a court hearing in the Columbus area to take a look at these large grow facilities. And a number of people have filed suits saying, like, the system of picking these people wasn't fair or not as transparent as it should have been. And so they are saying, you know, we need to either hold an injunction or redo it or something to that effect. And so that's what's being argued before the court. The court will make a decision. If the court,
which court is this?
It's Franklin County.
Okay. Common Pleas, isn't it?
I believe so. And so if they decide to hold this up, that could mean we're not going to hit our September deadlines for getting the medical marijuana program up and running. This is something that the various state agencies and lawmakers have been working on for 2 years. It's something that patients have been waiting for 2 years to be able to do this legally. And so any additional delay is just going to not sit well with a lot of people. But obviously, if the court says they have to stop or redo something, then they will have to do that.
Well, they'll have to do something because the Department of Commerce, under which the scoring and stuff was done, admitted that there was one large grow facility that actually should have been on the list, was one of the top, 10, 12, mm-hmm. and didn't get on that list, and that someone else got. So they'd have to add another one on top of that. And so that kind of calls into question, well, if you add this one, then what about the scoring on all these others? And, you know, it just opens a door as to how they can do that. And, you know, the judge could say in this case that, you know, we're putting it on hold. You know, you got to go back and do whatever. And if that does, I mean, September 8th is when the medical marijuana program is supposed to be fully functional or fully operational. That's the word. And we don't really know what that means. But we've already seen the Department of Commerce is saying, you know, that doesn't mean every grow site needs to be, you know, up and running. That doesn't mean every pharmacy is going to be able to do this. So they're already backing off and saying it might be more limited on September 8th, what we see. So we're not really sure at this point, and a lot of things are going to be determining this, including court suits.
So what does this mean for people who were counting on medical marijuana in Ohio? They're just not going to get it? Are they going to be able to get it somewhere else? Mm-hmm. Can the state contract? I mean, can they make it so that the people who need it?
Well, they might be
get
SOL,
it.
But here's another thing that's happening, too. On Friday, a group that's been trying to make marijuana legal, and there are several groups,
recreational,
by the way. Right.
Uh-huh.
This group wants to make it legal like alcohol. So basically, the idea is that marijuana would be the same as buying beer or cigarettes, and you would be 21, and it would be regulated in much the same way, yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. So anyway, this is one group that wants to make legal marijuana.
They want to put it on the ballot?
They want to put it on the ballot. They wanted to put it on the ballot this year, but they've lost a lot of time in the process of trying to get it there. And they have to get like 306,000 valid signatures to get it on the ballot. So that's a lot to collect mm-hmm. by July when they would have to have it. So now they're saying, you know, well, next year. They want it on the ballot in 2019. But they're in the process. They've had their petition approved at the Attorney General. Next thing they'll do is go to the ballot board and try to get that, you know, solidified there, which should happen soon, you know. And then they'll start getting that petition, getting their petition signatures out. If that medical marijuana program isn't up and isn't doing something real for patients, you might see those patients getting fatigued from this whole process and saying, you know what, we just make it available everywhere. You know, they might go off and put their support in other places, and it might embolden this group.
Yeah, that group's in pretty early stages, but, you know, you never know. It could certainly embolden those groups. I think for patients, there was some language in the law that you could get it from another state, but mm-hmm. and you wouldn't be penalized here in Ohio. But I don't know how effective that has been. I don't know how many people have kind of risked it, per se. And so I think largely they're going to be left waiting. And I think that's frustrating to a number of lawmakers, especially like Democrat Senator Kenny Yuko, who really pushed this legislation and wants it to happen yesterday, basically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, so we have just a few minutes left. What's coming up this week? We've already talked about a case in Franklin County Common Pleas on medical marijuana. What else is happening? We've got the speaker vote tomorrow for the Ohio House of Representatives. What else?
So I think after the speaker's vote, we could potentially have a vote on this legislation restricting payday lending, which has been at a bit of the heart of the probe into the former speaker, Cliff Rosenberger. There are some concerns that lobbyists went on trips with him to London and perhaps other places, and this legislation
and
wasn't
footed the bill.
And yeah, it was footed the, yeah. through GOPAC or NCSL, but which is paid for by donors and so forth. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's some concern that that bill might have been either stalled or delayed, or you know, not fully pushed forward because of that. And that's obviously something other folks are looking into, but this bill has been kind of a hot button topic ever since we learned that Cliff Rosenberger had hired an attorney. And so it'll be interesting to see the debate. It'll be interesting to see if there's any amendments or if they're just mm-hmm. getting it off the House floor as soon as possible.
Grease the skids and move that baby out. Yeah. What else? Anything?
Well, the state's trying to decide whether to go forward with the behavioral health redesign. This is Medicaid's program for coverage for people with behavioral health issues. It's going into managed care. It's one of the last programs under Medicaid to go into managed care, and they're looking at whether the system's ready. There's been a lot of complaints from providers, doctors, and such that they're not getting their payments on time and that the companies, the insurance companies, aren't ready for the change. Lawmakers are taking a hard look at this, and I wouldn't be surprised if this gets delayed again.
Kathy Kandisky, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's Kathy Kandisky, reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Jesse Ballmert of the Cincinnati Inquirer, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks for joining us.
Always great to be here.
That's it. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.